1, 2, 3, 4.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Film Dispenser Podcast. This is episode 149, Homeschool Film School. We're talking about Criterion Collection Blind Buys, and this is week is The Wages of Fear. I have with me my co-host for this series, Scott, from the West of Galveston and Beyond the North podcast for True Detective and Game of Thrones. Welcome, sir.
Thanks. How are you doing?
Good. After that mouthful, I need to take a deep breath. That was a lot of facts.
Yes, it was.
But yeah, this was this has been a fun series already, two in, and I'm having a blast. So I'm glad that we're doing this. I think we have some lighter-hearted subjects in the future. We're talking about doing a Roger Corman series with David, my current Film Dispenser podcast co-host. Adam, your co-host, is going to do some monster movies with me. But I was trying to think of Scott and I maybe in October should cycle back and do some horror movies with a comic twinge or something.
Ooh, that would be nice.
I was really trying to think of something that would be fun and in your personal wheelhouse, because I'm trying to tailor these to, you know, the people who are coming in as guests. And so I think that I would love to have Scott mark out 5 horror movies that are also going to make me laugh. I think that would be great.
Glad I have a wheelhouse. I feel better already.
You have many, sir. So what we do here every Friday on the Film Dispenser podcast is we talk about a film, usually a classic film. It could have been a more recent film, but it's usually to do with a theme. This, of course, Criterion Blind Buys, movies we bought out of the Criterion Collection, sight unseen, based on reputation, maybe the stars, maybe the actors, or maybe the directors, and we've never seen them. And we're finally taking off that cellophane and putting them in the Blu-ray player. Last week, we talked about Insomnia from 1997. You can see that, or you can hear that on episode 147. So go check that out if you haven't yet, and then watch The Wages of Fear before you listen to our conversation, because I think we're going to have some spoilers. I think the ending is worth talking about in retrospect, and the movie is old enough that I don't have a lot of sympathy necessarily, because people have had time, and you can also just pause this and go watch it.
Exactly.
So the movie came out in 1953, to give you that age there. It is the first film I have seen by, I'm going to try to pronounce his name. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Henri Georges Clouzot.
That's the way I would say it.
So Clouzot, I've never seen a film from Clouzot. Diabolique is a film I know a lot of people really like. Have you seen Diabolique?
It also has a Criterion edition, doesn't it?
It does indeed, and it's one of those I almost suggested for our blind buy, not knowing they were even connected.
Yes, I must admit that I have not seen that one.
I've heard
supposedly there is a bathtub scene in Diabolique that Hitchcock was answering with his shower scene in Psycho.
Interesting.
They were trying to one-up one another with means of death.
the DVD cover of that with this black background and the red letters and the eyes at the top of it, I've seen so many times. It's ingrained in my head. And so I'm shocked that I haven't seen it. But after seeing The Wages of Fear, I'm ready to watch it very soon. And that's kind of giving away my feelings on the film. I really enjoyed it. What did you think of The Wages of Fear?
Yeah, I really did as well. You know, it's interesting when you engage in seeing some of the older movies. And by older movies, you could just be talking about movies from even the 70s. And how it impacts the way that you view movies that followed that you thought were such landmark films.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a moment in Wages of Fear where I was like, oh, so that's where Speed came from.
Yep, absolutely.
And just like if you watch The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is a Criterion release, and you go, oh, that's where the town stole everything. And so it's nice to get a historical look at certain, you know, genres and thrillers and crime films and whatever it may be, because you realize that it's not so much new ideas as maybe new modern twists on ideas that have been done before. And so you see the groundwork that this film laid for thrillers that followed. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that's great. I mean, I was, you know, it's, you get a little nervous. You're doing a podcast and you have a 131 minute long movie to watch. That's a big investment in time. And so I was really happy to enjoy it. And I was, you know, some of the things I noticed and or knew about it going into it were the tension word is everywhere around this movie and has been for years. I read the Criterion little essay from Dennis Lehane, an author I'm sure you're well versed in as our crime expert.
Love Dennis.
Well, he has a great essay in the Blu-ray cover, and it's a really nice piece, but it, of course, tension comes up there. But for me, for years, that's the reason to see this movie, is how tense it is. Like, you're not going to believe how tense it is, and it's so good at building tension and holding tension and releasing tension. And I was very nervous that I'm going to spend this long, like, looking for tension. And I got to say, it did take an hour for it to get there. Because because they set up so much, but man, when it starts, yeah, like I better than speed, and yeah, that whole scene with the where they're having to keep a certain mile per hour or under, like you can only do one or the other, is great. And I can't imagine having seen this in the theater for the first time before so many things that have copied it. How thrilling that must have been!
You know, it it's interesting because you mentioned the long setup. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that after I watch the film, I try not to read any kind of scholarship or much criticism on a film before I'm going to watch it, because I want to kind of frame my own opinion and notice what I notice. And so through that fairly lengthy setup, I kept thinking about Hitchcock. I kept thinking about films like Rear Window, where you have maybe just Rear Window is just one setting. This has a few settings. But you're in this kind of confined space with a cast of characters getting to know the, you know, their habits, their character traits, their personalities, and then we're going to inject the tension into the situation. And so it was interesting, after I had seen the movie, I started reading a little bit about Wages of Fear and read that Clouseau had such a competitive relationship with Hitchcock, that they were always trying to one-up one another and see, you know, just how much of a pressure cooker can we put an audience in. And it's funny that, you know, Wages of Fear is a 1953 release, and the film that it was reminding me of, Rear Window, was the very next year.
Huh.
In 1954.
That's
so
funny.
Stylistically, they probably are similar, and they're engaging in similar techniques. And it was interesting just to read a little bit of that history between these two directors, that they considered themselves to be in competition with one another to deliver the greatest thriller there is.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that's some context I didn't have. And I think it's really fun to now look at. I want to watch more of Clouseau's films so that I can then compare the years and the films of both directors. Like I'm now like, let's just stop this and do a Clouseau series, because I just want to watch the rest of his films. It's funny, a movie like The Wages of Fear, in taking basically the first more than third of the film to just establish a place, I start thinking about why are we doing this? Why are we taking the time to just hang around this one particular location? And are we trying to build the characters? And I don't really know that was it, because I feel like the characters are types and they're meant to be types. But what I feel like they do is they build the setting in such a way that I believe that they would do anything, that these types would do anything they could to get out of this place.
Right.
And I feel like that's what that first hour does for me, so that when they take this job, I never once go, why would they do this? Because that is the killer of so many movies for me. It's like, there's no way. Why would they do this? Why in the world would they not just call the cops or leave the house or whatever? And in this case, I totally bought every choice that they made. Did you find that to be true as well?
Yeah, that's a good point that, you know, I think in my little roster of things that I said the introduction did, I mentioned character, but, you know, you're right. The characters are fairly well set. It's not like the characters really evolve in any way in that opening 45 minutes. I guess a more accurate way to describe it is it's building motivation. Yeah. And so that intro is building motivation as to why would they undertake this, you know, lethal, seemingly impossible task. And it's because the first 45 minutes to an hour of the film just build this picture of this place where, you know, dreams go to die. Just, you know, this hopeless kind of place that all of them have varying stories and reasons for wanting to get out of and go to something else.
You know, it's the way it starts with the cockroaches and everything. Immediately, it's like, whoa, I don't want to be here. And it just builds from there. And I think it's the best way to do this, because I think while movies today seem to very much want to go, here's a lean 90 minutes, very little like in terms of big action movies, and let's barrel forward, like Mission Impossible, a film we reviewed, a Rogue Nation that we reviewed earlier this week, is a movie I really enjoyed, but that's the only way you can sustain good action movies at this point, is you just sort of know all the players and they just kind of play on the board, and this method of storytelling with action and tension and excitement seems to have really gone by the wayside, especially in American cinema. And I really appreciated it. I really was excited to take the journey with these people when they first get in their trucks. It's like, oh man, let's do this. And that was such a nice experience. One of the things I noticed in the movie, and then it was sort of nice to get affirmed by the Lehane essay, is there's a lot of like pretty pointed anti-American and very anti, almost commercialism, but anti-industry, in terms of how we see these shots of like the oil fire, and there's like the natives standing in front of it, with hardly any clothes on, and being yelled at by the workers from the company, and the company are the ones who are saying we're willing to put these people's lives at risk. And it was interesting to see or to read about how much this movie got in trouble for that over here. And I do say that where I say it's a positive or it's a negative that we don't get this kind of storytelling now, I think it's a positive that this kind of storytelling in terms of opened opinion can come anywhere and be anywhere. We can see it at its full length, because I didn't realize how privileged we were to be able to see it so easily.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, the film was trimmed for its American release. Mm-hmm. And so they cut 21 minutes out of the film to show it here in the States. And part of it was they thought that there were homosexual undertones to some of the relationships, and so I thought that was interesting. But the other part of it was they actually trimmed down some of the evil corporate America rhetoric and scenes to release it here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously they knew at the time this wasn't going to make, you know, America, or at least corporate America, all that happy.
And you know, I think that the messages in the film and the opinions that are on display, what makes the movie so good, in my opinion, as a piece of art, if America changed to a different country tomorrow, those messages would be the exact same, even if it's not the same label. This idea of destroying nature and destroying places and using people as expendable tools is something that would exist in every country in some way. And I like that they're exploring these things, but while they're very obvious, it's not the tension and the story still remains with our characters. So we're able to explore it. I'm able to think on it without it being shoveled into my brain. And I like this dynamic of, yes, there, you know, there's these shots where you see like Southern Oil Company, like in the top half of the frame throughout a whole scene. But the conversation and below that sign is so riveting that I get the point, but it doesn't, for whatever reason, it doesn't feel overbearing and overly symbolic. Did you find any of the messages overbearing at any point?
No, I didn't. And, you know, maybe it's growing up in an age of, you know, overt advertising
right.
and film and television and product placement and, you know, brand recognition and all that kind of stuff. Maybe we feel it even less. But no, I didn't think that it intruded into the story that was being told. And honestly, I thought that it was, you know, kind of secondary to everything that was going on. I mean, that may be the company that is behind the offer that has been made to kind of liberate these men if they can complete this mission. But then once they're off on the mission itself, which is a good 90 minutes of the film almost, all of that really becomes irrelevant.
Right. So there's a little thing that I noticed. We had Mario and Luigi as characters. I'm trying to lighten the mood for a moment. But there's these characters, Mario and Luigi, and the whole time I'm like, did the Nintendo game just steal? And I thought, how wonderful would it be if their inspiration of naming these characters came because someone loved The Wages of Fear.
Right.
And I did a little bit of research, and it seems to not be the case, but in my head I'm going to ignore that research and now just say, like, it's definitely inspired by The Wages of Fear, because I was like, wow, this is so funny. Like, this would have meant nothing in 1953, but now it's so – I like that a movie adds layers of context, because that's a huge industrial business, and the Nintendo business, and it's this connection that it's just so timeless, The Wages of Fear, that I can connect it to even the silliest of things today.
It's probably because that's like the 1953 equivalent of like Mike and Jim or something in those respective languages.
Exactly. And you know, but looking at the rest of the film and looking at it a little bit more serious, one of the things that I really appreciated, I'm not a huge fan, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, of the, now I'm forgetting what the term is, but where they light the background with an image that moves as a car drives to make it
right,
look...
Right, the rear projection.
Rear projection, kinda, thank you.
Right.
I'm not a huge fan of that. Because most of the time it is distracting to me. I don't mind it in theory because I don't care. And I don't like a CGI sometimes doesn't hold up over time, but if the story isn't affected by that, it's not a big deal. It's not if it's not distracting. But it's often distracting. But I found that what I thought was fairly simple rear projection scenes and not necessarily like, I would say Kubrick has done some amazing rear projection that you can't even tell until you see like behind the scenes photos. This is not like that.
The Tom Cruise on a treadmill.
That's one of my very favorite. Yeah, that's so good. And that's a movie I watched last year, Eyes Wide Shut. And I was like, no way. Is that like, I just, anyway. But just, so here I'm going, oh, I hate rear projection. But the dialogue and the story and the tension distracted me from that so much that I ended up respecting how much I felt like Clouseau knew that the story he's telling was bigger than any other thing, because there's a lot of moments of tension where you're just looking at a close-up of two guys in the front seat of the truck.
Right.
And that's all it is. Like, you can't see the road below them. You very rarely see, like, what the terrain is they're actually going over by comparison to looking at them just driving the truck.
Right.
All of that's... Go ahead.
And while I was watching, I had the same thought about rear projection. And I think a lot of what it is given the size of the truck and the way that they frame the shots, you don't actually see much of it. Mm-hmm. There's a little border at the top, maybe a little border on the sides, and then I think there's like a flap behind them that you can see through behind them. And so one of the reasons that it didn't become distracting for me is it kind of provided almost more the illusion of movement and driving, mm-hmm. as opposed to having some big full screen shot behind them of, you know, fake terrain going by.
Right. And for me, it works. I mean, it doesn't ever feel like it's a car that's just bouncing up and down on some sort of stage.
Right.
It never feels that way. It does. I mean, the background, if you look at it, you feel that that's not there. But I never felt that the car wasn't in motion or the truck wasn't in motion. And that's just a technical detail, but it's something that often I nitpick. And in this case, it just completely it sold it for me. Is there anything about the film that you weren't a fan of or that really stood out to you either way?
You know, not that I wasn't a fan of the one of the things that I really liked about it is anytime you give me just kind of a, almost like a single sentence premise for a movie, my immediate reaction is, how are you going to turn that into a whole movie? Mm-hmm. So you say to me, yeah, well, you know, that's the one about Robert Redford floating on a boat in the ocean for an hour and a half. And you're thinking, God, how in the world are you going to turn that into a movie? And so with this, it's, oh, yeah, that's the one with the guys, you know, driving the truck with the nitroglycerin. And you're thinking, well, how are you going to make that into at least a full-length movie? And so I thought they did a really nice job of each stage of the trip having a different problem that they had to troubleshoot. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about improvising these solutions to the different things that come their way. So there's one, you know, that is speed oriented. I need to drive a certain speed or the truck's going to shake to the point that it might go off. Then you have the issue with the kind of rickety beginnings of a bridge as to how am I going to corner here. We get the debris in the way section. And so I thought they did a really nice job of putting different kinds of obstacles in front of them as they drive that to change it up. They completely avoid any of the monotony that you might expect in the kind of premise that they have.
Yeah, I mean, the scene where they are attempting to blow up the giant boulder mm-hmm. was just fantastic. The tension of I love there's this moment where one of the characters tells Luigi, I believe, to dig a hole in the rock that's 30 inches deep. And mm-hmm. it's like, oh, my Lord, like that's going to take so long. But they convey like the exhaustion and the sweat. They sort of they fade to black and come back out and he's done the job and he's exhausted. And the pole is all raggedy at the bottom and covered in this white powder from the rock. And it just slowly builds this thing of like, how are they going to do this? Can they do it? If they do it, is everybody going to make it? And you even for a moment think someone didn't make it. And I think here's where I'll sort of again reiterate, this is the idea for this series is that you've watched the film before you listen to the podcast. So we're going to kind of jump into some spoilery stuff now. But the idea that you go through all of this tension and all of this trial, and I felt like I was on the edge of my seat, like, are they going to do this? Are they going to have to figure out a different way down the mountain? My head's going in all these directions, but they do it. And they get through it and they make it, and not a moment later do we get this what I felt was this just amazing shock of an explosion where the match goes out and the wind blows and the light happens on the eyes of our main characters.
Yeah, the flash of light.
Oh my gosh, man. I just that reversal where I thought I was coming down off the tension, my tension just went straight back up for the rest of the film. After that moment, it's like I can't just be comfortable with anything because they just made it and they lost everything.
And I thought that led to a really clever twist or furthering of what I was talking about with having different obstacles in front of their path that they had the explosion shear the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so what should have begun the easier part of their trip, getting back on decent roads and nearing the camp, has all of a sudden become their most difficult obstacle yet.
And all of the shots of them covered in oil and going through that pool and the moment where the car is coming towards Joe and Mario's basically deciding he's driving at any cost. All of that stuff, I mean, it just everything that has come before informs this moment and then the reactions to what has happened afterwards, it just all feels earned and real. And even though Mario makes a bad choice and hurts Joe, the fact that he is broken up about it in the car with Joe as Joe's dying, it feels like a natural human reaction from this person. And I buy everything that happens afterwards.
Did you read anything about just what a disaster the production was?
No, but I would believe almost anything you told me because it seems like a treacherous and hot and miserable experience.
Well, it was interesting. They said, first off, evidently, you know, I'm sitting there looking at the scene with the sheared off pipe. and all the oil being pushed out. And I'm thinking, I guess in modern terms, I'm like, oh, I wonder if they just like make chocolate syrup or something. You know, what are they wallowing around in there? And the answer is actual crude oil.
Oh.
And so both those guys got sick.
Oh, wow. I believe.
And they had to postpone the production for them to get better. And then evidently in one of the kind of rocky areas, Clouseau broke his ankle. And so he got hurt during the production. And then it rained and rained and rained and rained. And so during this film, they actually suspended production for 6 months.
Wow.
And then came back and resumed photography.
Right.
And the irony is, and this was something that I already knew about the 1970s, you know, remake of The Sorcerer, which was made by William Friedkin, and it's about a group of men transporting this kind of sweaty old dynamite a long distance. They built a bridge. They wholesale built a bridge with hydraulics so that they could rock the truck and make it look like it's, you know, about to fall off of this rickety bridge. And then what happened was it was the driest season in that location ever, and there was no river for them to go over because of a drought.
Oh, wow.
So Wages of Fear was delayed by too much rain. And the remake Sorcerer was delayed by a lack of rain, and Friedkin went way over budget because he made them transport the bridge to another location where they would have water and then film those sequences there.
I mean, I'm ready to go watch Sorcerer right now. That's incredible.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you think of like the mid-70s and you don't realize that, you know, I mean, these days, oh, if you need a bunch of water running under a bridge, we just CG it in.
Yeah.
And so they had location scouted a place that when they scouted it, there was a big river going through there. And 6 months later, when they came to film, it had been a record drought and there was no water.
Wow, wow. That's incredible. And I mean, I feel like that passion for the film and the struggles that they have to overcome, you hear so many great stories of overcoming trials in great films. So if you have it really easy, you don't necessarily always get the most exciting product. And I like that it feels like that much effort was put into the final product. It just feels worked in and worked on. That scene where they're going around the bend where there's like the broken bridge platform kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, man. Like I'm not very uneasy with height, but all of a sudden, like, this is just too tense. Like, and I don't like the idea of falling and this idea of them losing control of the car and that, or the truck, and that being why they could fall to their death. All of these things just start building and building. And it's like, I can't imagine then what that would have been like to film. And I respect so much that it was done.
The tire half on and half off.
Oh, that's the worst.
Of the bridge. Yeah, that was amazing.
So in terms of the ending, we get quite a bleak ending.
I didn't think it really fit the film, but maybe that's just me.
For me, where I felt that it was lost was Mario's odd joy of getting the money and almost having lost everything. There's a scene before the happy swerving drive that's ultimately fatal, where he's walking towards the fire of the oil and he collapses. And I literally went, oh, cool, that's a great ending. Like, in my head, like, it's fade to black and we're done. And then it goes on a little further, and we get this cut back and forth to this woman who's Clouseau's wife in real life, Vera.
Yes.
But we get a cut back to her character, and she's excited he's coming back and he's alive, and they're dancing, and she passes out, and he drives his car off a cliff because he's driving like an idiot on the way back.
Right.
And sort of giggling and laughing and happy and excited and all these good things. And then, but he's just had this like nervous mental breakdown because he's killed his friend. He's killed a man for greed. I agree. It just fell off in his happiness and his excitement. Then he dies as well. Like, I think that there's the wages of fear to me should be what he's left with. That's the cost. And instead, it seems like the answer is simply death. And that's a little too simple for the movie that I watched until that last couple minutes.
No, I agree. I agree completely. I had thought it would be an ending where you just wouldn't know all of the answers.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, does he go back to the woman? They seem very love, hate, on again, off again. Does he actually get out of the country and go realize whatever dream he wants to realize? And I just figured that we would fade to black with those questions yet to be answered because they weren't really the central point of the film. Mm-hmm. And so I had a hard time believing someone who had so carefully driven his delicate cargo across the terrain would be driving back like a maniac.
Right. Yeah.
I tell you, when they pulled, I honestly thought when they pulled the truck up for him to get in, mm-hmm. and you couldn't see anything in the bed of the truck, it had those kind of wooden sides to it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were going to tell him, well, you do know that it was a round trip.
Right.
And it was going to be loaded with nitroglycerin to go back.
Yeah, I mean, that then would have been...
Yeah, exactly. I thought, oh, my gosh. And then when they showed the back and it was just empty, I thought, oh, okay. Whew. You know, I wasn't sure how that made sense because he was bringing it to them because they didn't have any. But for just one brief moment, I thought they were going to break the news to him that, you know, you've done one leg of two.
Right. And yeah, and that would have fit very much with this idea that they just can do whatever they need to do to these paid workers.
Exactly.
And yeah, I mean, I think that would have fit well. And I'm always good with the fade to black at an inconvenient time at the end of a movie. And I just think of him passing out in front of the fire, to me, I would have been just perfectly happy.
The Robert Redford movie that I used as an example, you could say the same thing about it.
That one,
On All Is Lost.
3 seconds shorter, that movie should have been. 3 seconds shorter. But yeah, I mean, overall, though, I mean, I would say I'm at 99% on this movie. It is very much the very end that I'm kind of like, not so much, but it's not so egregious that it ruins anything about the experience of watching it. And I'm like, again, thrilled that we have watched another really fascinating and interesting film. I mean, the Criterion Collection has yet to do me wrong. I'm not a full expert. I haven't watched hundreds of their movies, but it's another great pick, and I feel like it lived up to the hype. Did it live up to the hype for you in terms of your blind buy?
Yeah, it really did. I'm always curious to see what can be done with the limited technology that existed at the time to generate suspense,
mm-hmm.
and to kind of keep you on the edge of your seat. And so I thought they did a great job with that. One of the scenes that we didn't mention that I thought was really effective was the one where they're loading the boulder with the nitro. We talked about that. But the part where they focus on everybody's nervous tic.
Oh, yeah.
And so you see one of them kind of, you know, rubbing his fingers together, and you see the other one, you know, drumming his hand on the door, and, you know, they're all kind of, you know, sweaty and, you know, furtively looking around. And so it was just great how they went about generating suspense without needing a bunch of practical effects or explosions or what have you to carry it off. And so to me, that is really the art of when Hitchcock was making movies and when Clouseau was making movies, that you weren't able technically to do a lot of the things that I'm sure were running through their brain. If only we could do X, and to figure out a way to create the suspense without having that tool at your disposal.
And I think, you know, you look back and that's what gave us all of the great things that they did. Hitchcock today, is he Eli Roth? I mean, like, who is he today? And that's sacrilege, and I don't mean that literally, but I mean, just figuratively, like, where is he with an unlimited resource like computer animation? It's very curious to think about that, and I think this is a great example of how much you can do with the limitations of the time, because it works. It really does. Next week on Homeschool Film School, we are talking about 1961's Lola from Jacques Demy. It's the first film in the Jacques Demy box set from the Criterion Collection. So go check that out before next week. It is only 87 minutes. We seem to be nice to everybody in that we are balancing out the long and the shorts. But that will be next Friday. You can find me on Twitter at SpenLuke, S-P-E-N-L-U-K-E, and you can email the show at filmdispenser@gmail.com. If you have any comments on the movies that we're watching or anything coming up and you'd like us to read them on the episode or just sort of to inspire conversation that you'd like to hear, feel free to send that our way. And Scott, where can they find you, sir?
Yes, I can be found on Twitter at Flat Earth Scott, which is a homage to my very late adoption of social media. And I am one of the co-hosts of the West of Galveston podcast, which is covering currently True Detective Season 2. And if you're only just now getting around to binge-watching Game of Thrones, I'm also the co-host of Beyond the North, our Game of Thrones podcast. And we have 10 or 11 episodes to go with the most recent season of Game of Thrones.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm actually a huge fan of Game of Thrones, and I used to listen to lots of Game of Thrones podcasts, and not to toot my own website's horn, but yours is the only one I listen to. So I very much recommend that if you have not checked it out. Guys, thank you so much for joining us this week. If you want to find the full list of the movies that we're watching, they'll be in the show notes, and that we have a link to a list on Letterboxd that our fan Reese Pie made for us, so you can follow and watch along there. So thank you very much for joining us for Homeschool Film School. Episode 150 of the Film Dispenser podcast is coming up soon. We're doing a little something funny. I'm just going to say, tune in on Tuesday to see what's going on, but all is not as you would think it would be, and that's as much as I will tease at the moment. So until then, we will talk to you next week.